It takes work. Even with great talent, success only comes after long, tedious hours at the piano, a life dedicated to a single goal. Then there's luck, strength of character to surmount personal tragedy and bear crushing public expectation. Take all that and one of the most celebrated partnerships in music history, and you have the story of Joan Sutherland, a gauche young woman from Sydney who went on to conquer the world. Diva, prima donna, la stupenda.
A great human being, a very good friend, a very loyal friend, somebody who took herself seriously when it was important to take herself seriously, but she was an amazingly humble person. I don't think she ever realised she was as great, as stupendous as the rest of us knew she was.
She had an incredibly interesting combination of down-to-earth reality and then this incredibly exquisite voice, which is always difficult for a singer to have that amount of success and remain true to yourself and cope with the pressure of, you know, the common cold being your worst enemy often. It needs a particular type of inner strength, and I think that Joan Sutherland always had that.
There was no room for prima donna antics in the Sutherland household. In an interview, the singer recalled you'd have been sent off to bed without dinner at any hint of temperament. Joan Sutherland was born on the 7th of November 1926 in the Sydney suburbs, youngest child of William Sutherland, a Presbyterian Scot, and his second wife Muriel. Joan's mother was a gifted mezzo-soprano who'd been taught by a pupil of Matilda Marchese, teacher of the great Nellie Melba. From her earliest years, the child would sit beside her mother at the piano, imitating her vocalese exercises and joining her in duets from the opera. From 1905, Australian soprano Nellie Melba with her signature encore song, Home Sweet Home. When she was just six, Joan's father died. The family was split up, and Joan, her mother and her sister Barbara went to live with her mother's family. The little girl found refuge from grief in the gramophone recordings of great divas, Melba, Galicorci and Poncel, and she dreamed of one day being an opera singer like them. But reality told a different story. Little Joan Sutherland was a sturdy, plain child, sweet-natured but desperately shy, and there was no money to support her studies. Following school, she became a secretary, and after work doggedly practiced her scales and the songs her mother had taught her. The first break came when Joan won a scholarship for vocal training. She'd started off as a mezzo, or lower soprano, but Joan's new teachers decided she was in fact a higher, dramatic soprano voice. This opened up a new repertoire, and Sutherland set to study Wagnerian roles. She was, she said, crazy about Kirsten Flagstad. After several attempts, another break. Joan won a national singing prize, enabling her to travel to England to pursue her dream. But with victory came the news that Joan's adored elder sister Barbara had committed suicide. The young girl was distraught, but resolute. She had to take this chance. In 1951, Joan Sutherland embarked for London with her mother, her sights set on Covent Garden. When Joan and Muriel Sutherland arrived in London, a young man was there to meet them. Richard Bonning was a fellow Australian, a gifted pianist who'd won a scholarship to the Royal College of Music, but left to pursue his passion for opera repertory. He'd accompanied Joan at a couple of recitals in Sydney, and like many was struck by the size and beauty of her voice. But her lack of stage skill and a sameness of tone in performance told against Sutherland in her early auditions. She was accepted for a year at the opera school and in her spare time rehearsed with Bonning, who had his own ideas about Joan's voice. She wasn't a dramatic soprano, he insisted, but a dramatic coloratura, a high-register voice made for the theatrics of bel canto opera. Anthony Legg is music director at Opera Australia and the Sir Arthur Sullivan visiting professor at the Royal Academy of Music in London.
She had a big voice. There was no question about that. It was a beautiful quality, but it was big. And so, of course, they were confused because, you know, if you've got a big voice, then you should sing Wagner. Richard felt that this was not good for her because she wouldn't have a long career, because he's very understanding, especially with young singers, that it's not just singing well, but you want to have a long career. You don't want to just sing for 10 years and finish. So he took her under his wing. And, of course, that was great because, you know, he married her. And he made her... And she was very willing to do this, to do lots of exercises about flexibility, stretching her voice in the sense of not trying to make it big, but trying to make it rounded and beautiful at all times, not trying to put any steel into it. And especially this flexibility, which a lot of singers don't have this ability to do thousands of exercises like a pianist does. Or Varnes does. It's very boring, and it's not, you know, it's not something which is very exciting. But she was willing to do it. He would transpose exercises up semitones, and so she wouldn't know what note she was singing. So she found the top of her voice, and found these wonderful top notes, but she didn't know what note it was because she didn't worry about it because it wasn't written down. It was just he said just sing this, and then slowly take it up. And of course, that's the ideal way of learning to sing, that you have that wonderful flexibility. You can do perfect trills, you can do Messa the Voce, and all these complicated things, which are not interesting in one sense, but you have to have that technique because the old singers always had that technique. Nowadays, everyone learns music extremely fast and they're very clever about it, but they actually can't do the basic exercises, so they haven't got the technique to sing what's on the page.
Thank you.
On her fourth audition, Sutherland was finally offered a contract by the Royal Opera House Covent Garden and joined the roster of sopranos. She became known as a reliable trooper, standing in for sick colleagues and taking on a wide variety of roles, notably Vega's Agatha in Der Freischutz, Mozart's Pamina and Countess, and several Wagner heroines. The opera house was still confused as to what kind of a voice she had. While still churning out weighty dramatic arias, Joan had developed a remarkable upper register, and prompted by Bonning, she began to lobby for high soprano roles. There was the continuing problem of her awkward stage presence, exacerbated by the girl's large frame and shyness. Drama coach Norman Ayrton worked on her acting and movement, and later recalled how he banned Joan from assuming a GPE, a general pained expression, her usual fallback on stage. Bonning took charge of Joan's appearance, overseeing her wardrobe and diet, and deciding on the auburn hair colour that became her trademark. The transformation complete, Joan got her prince. She and Bonning were married in 1954, and a little over a year later their son Adam was born. All the while, Richard Bonning continued in his quest to make Joan the great bel canto singer of her time, to revive a type of opera that had been forgotten for decades. What exactly is bel canto singing? Annalise Miskimmen is the artistic director of Opera Theatre Company.
It is necessary, if you're going to sing bel canto rep as a singer, to have a complete control of your technique. And that control can only be engaged and learnt through hours of painstaking, really dismantling and putting together of the voice in a way that prioritises the beauty of tone, the clarity, the beauty of line, innate musicality, and an awful lot of blood, sweat and tears in achieving it. It's a different way, perhaps, of looking at the voice, this kind of rep, than someone like Wagner, who reacted against it, where the primacy of emotion and words actually was absolutely vital. And there was always, and still is, people still talk about a division of tension between people would trivialise sometimes bel canto repertoire and performers who specialise in it as being singing machines, as being larynxes on legs, as opposed to a more actorly, I suppose, view of what opera should be, where you're really an actor who is emoting through their voice. Bel canto aficionados would often say that the voice and the primacy of the voice and the technique is the most important thing about opera, whereas often beauty in the voice for other specialists would be more about expressing an emotion.
Thank you.
Torna mi a vagheggiar from Handel's Alcina. Baroque opera was the birthplace of bel canto singing, and in 1950s London, a revival of interest in music of that period led to the creation of a Handel Opera Society. Sutherland created a sensation as Handel's fabulous sorceress Alcina, and she was hailed by critics as one of the singers of the day. There were further successes in Handel performances and in the high lyric roles of Gilda in Verdi's Rigoletto and Mozart's Donna Anna. She now had powerful supporters, Lord Harewood and David Webster, General Administrator of Covent Garden. Thanks to their lobbying, the stage was now set for Sutherland's great test, the title role in a new Covent Garden production of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor. There was already a bel canto diva to contend with, one whose passion and glamour mesmerised the world. Maria Callas had made her Covent Garden debut with Bellini's Norma in 1952. Sutherland was cast in the small role of Clotilde, and after the performance she asked Callas whether it was possible that she too could one day sing Norma. "It would be hard work," said Callas, "but why not?" Now Sutherland was to take on another role that Callas had made her own, Donizetti's tragic Lucia, driven to madness and murder. Her conductor was Callas's own mentor, Tullio Serafin, and directing was the young Franco Zeffirelli. "You are a star now, stand up straight," she was told, and under their direction, Joan became that fragile, lovely creature of romantic imagining. The maestro Serafin was enchanted by this voice, of such extraordinary strength, yet with a suppleness and clarity from its lowest register to a ringing high E. He promised Sutherland a sixpence for her E on the opening night and made good on his word. The coin stayed with her always. That February night in 1959 became one of the most memorable in 20th century opera. The house erupted in a frenzy at Lucia's mad scene, where she descended a staircase in a blood-spattered nightgown. Critics sought to outdo each other in praise of Sutherland's voice. After years of punishing work, she was an overnight success. "Well, what do you know?" was her dazed response to the endless ovations. And the triumph continued as opera houses around the world made frantic efforts to book this new prima donna. Joan was rechristened La Stupenda by ecstatic Venetian audiences at her performance of Alcina at La Fenice. La Regina è morta, viva la Regina, trumpeted the newspapers after Sutherland's debut with Lucia at La Scala. The Queen is dead, long live the Queen. A cruel cut at Callas and typical of the partisanship of the opera world. Sutherland versus Callas. How do they compare? Anthony Legg.
Well, Maria Callas was obviously a fantastic person in her own right. I mean, she changed the style of acting completely. So because she was completely involved in the role and she got inside the character so much that she was always, the music was always important to her. She was incredibly accurate and she always understood it, though she would take quite big risks with her voice. So sometimes it wasn't a beautiful sound. She was very clever at changing her style of singing for different roles. Joan wouldn't have done that because she wasn't so much interested in the acting side. So she was more of the old-fashioned style of singing, that it was all about the sound and the music does it. She didn't, I mean, it always was a great performance because her singing made the acting. But Maria Callas was more interested in the psychology of acting. And certainly she changed the world and with Tito Gobbi into a different, well, what we have now, which is that we expect singers to act and now they look fantastic as well.
Just as her star shot into ascent, Joan was faced with the prospect of never singing again. Since childhood, she had been troubled with sinus infections and abscesses in her ears, and during her early career endured periods of excruciating pain. Rehearsals had started for the Covent Garden production of Lucia when Sutherland was faced with a stark choice, an operation which could damage her vocal cords and ruin her career, or the certainty of life as an invalid. Shortly after the Lucia premiere, she underwent the procedure, which left her voiceless for a month, only capable of dry, scratchy sounds. Miraculously, the voice returned, and Joan took up a daunting schedule of operas, concerts and recitals. Her dedication became legend. The ensemble trooper turned diva, who never complained, never missed a rehearsal, and bore discomfort with a stoic resolve. Moffat Oxenbould is the former artistic director of Opera Australia and director with the Houston Grand Opera.
She was a very honest performer. She believed that she was given a gift, and that was a privilege, and she developed that gift and had a responsibility to her talent. But she loved her audience, and she was always very aware of the obligation that people had paid perhaps a lot of money and that they'd looked forward to a major event. And she took the responsibility that she was singing prima donna roles very, very seriously. Because if the performance didn't work for any reason, she thought, well, I've only got myself to blame. So she was very disciplined. She had usually two days between performances, not always on that Sutherland Williamson tour in 1965, but she would never go out the night before she had a performance. She was always looking at her music. I remember years later I was in New York, and she was singing Lucia. I was staying in their apartment with them, and Lucia was being televised from the Met on that particular evening. But in the morning, she was there in her sitting room with her score, going through the score. She must have sung Lucia countless times, but she never took anything for granted.
After bad experiences with conductors who disliked or didn't know bel canto repertoire, Sutherland made it a condition of her engagements that her husband, Richard Bonning, be her conductor. This raised the hackles of several leading opera houses. A supremely gifted musician, Bonning still had no official training in conducting, and critics dismissed him as merely a cafe conductor. But for Sutherland, the partnership was essential. Not only had Richard a complete understanding of her voice and its capabilities, but he was, as she put it, the architect of my career, carefully choosing roles to highlight Joan's strengths and to prolong the vitality of her voice. Anthony Legg.
To have someone like Joan who was willing to let him, you know, coach her, and, you know, he would be quite tyrannical with her sometimes, which is good because, you know, it takes a huge discipline to sing as well as that. And it was, you know, it's a big strain for her to keep at that standard because it's, you know, it's easy to say, oh, well, that's because she's famous. But in actual fact, every day was sometimes a torment because you're judged all the time and you're only as good as your last performance. But Richard had a understanding of bel canto music. I mean, he would agree that he wasn't a fantastic orchestral conductor, but he understood how it worked in the old days, in the sense of when you see the orchestral parts of even early Verdi, we discovered that things were cut out, or they were transposed, or things were, bars were cut. Lots of things which are doing to make it work for the singer. The composer didn't worry about that. He wrote a kind of general amount of music, but if you needed to cut bits, it was absolutely accepted that you do that. If you had to transpose it, we found that from Bellini, that when he revised something, he completely revised it because it was another singer. So, okay, let's rewrite it. The other point is that the old conductors, especially up to the Second World War, always coached the singers themselves. They always knew the singers intimately and knew exactly all their discrepancies, and if they came, maybe sometimes they had to move on somewhere because that was better vocally. And therefore, when they got with the orchestra, they had that in their blood and could conduct the orchestra and help the orchestra understand that.
Gradually, the opera houses came around to the idea of the Sutherland-Bonning package. If you want the meat, you have to have the bones, was an ungracious quip by Rudolf Bing, manager of the New York Met. Bonning soon commanded respect as an opera conductor in his own right, and under his direction, Sutherland built on her repertoire with an array of bel canto roles. Bellini's I Puritani, Beatrice di Tenda and La Sonnambula, Handel's Giulio Cesare and Rodelinda, Donizetti's Lucrezia Borgia and Anna Bolena, and Rossini's Semiramide. Meanwhile, Bonning's research widened to include the neglected field of French Romantic opera. Masterpieces such as Delibes' Lakme, Offenbach's Tales of Hoffmann, Meyerbeer's Les Huguenots, and Massenet's Le Roi de Lahore and Esclaramonde were revived for Sutherland's unique talents, the strength and brilliance of her voice coping easily with the often phenomenal demands of the musical score. But she was also game to let her hair down. Dinah Shore, Ella Fitzgerald and Joan Sutherland riffing together on American TV. This was a golden age of audio and visual recording. From the outset, Sutherland was broadcast on BBC Radio with the Covent Garden Repertory Company, and even before her first triumph with Lucia, she had recorded operas. Post-Lucia, she was signed up to Decca Label and throughout her career gave landmark interpretations in a vast array of repertoire. In the United States, she made frequent appearances on national syndicates such as The Ed Sullivan Show and The Bell Telephone Hour. Despite Joan's fear of the TV camera and its intrusive shots of her wide open mouth, she accepted its power to reach a far wider audience than an opera house could offer. Anthony Legg on the role of technology in Sutherland's career.
But she was lucky to come at the time of recordings. If she'd come now, the recording industry is completely folded in that sense. I mean, of course, there are recordings, but not at the level of going to the studio with Decca and EMI and, you know, doing Kingsway Hall and doing all these fantastic recordings and coming out, you know, they were doing them every week. That doesn't happen at all anymore because it's too expensive. So she was lucky to be. If she hadn't been such a recorded artist, it might have been slightly different because she might have obviously been known by the opera houses who used her, but not known so well as internationally.
Despite the huge success she enjoyed in Europe and America, Sutherland's dream was to return home and perform in Australia. This finally came about in 1965, when together with Bonning and a cast, including several Australian expats, they arrived in Sydney for the Sutherland Williamson International Grand Opera Tour. Moffat Oxenbould was a young member of the management team.
It was a crazy time because it was 14 weeks of performances of seven operas, five of which Joan Sutherland sang in. We did one on a Saturday night. I think we did three premieres in the first week and then basically one every other week until we had seven. Performed for 14 weeks in four capital cities. And there were some wonderful, wonderful singers. A couple of Australians who had been singing with Joan and Richard in Covent Garden or in Britain, Loris Elms, Robert Allman. Then there was a young Italian tenor that nobody had much heard of at that time called Luciano Pavarotti, and he sang three times a week. So we opened in Melbourne. It was an incredible homecoming. But I think we'd all heard Joan sing on recording. She hadn't been back in Australia since she left as a student or as a competition winner to try her luck abroad. But the reality of hearing her sing was so much more than we had imagined it could be. And the public responded. I think many of them came because it was an opportunity to hear an iconic Australian, and it was a sort of obligation, a national obligation to do it. But they became wildly enthusiastic. And so for a piece like Semiramide, which was Rossini's serious opera that hadn't been performed in Australia since the 19th century, the only Rossini that was done really was Barbara Seville here, was a discovery. Sonnambula was a discovery. And Joan sang three times a week, not the same opera every week. She sang maybe Lucia on Monday, and on Wednesday would sing Traviata and Semiramide on Saturday. So it was a very, very demanding schedule. She didn't miss a performance. At the start, she even came in to rehearse the morning after a performance the night before because we were running out of rehearsal time.
Thank you.
Alle più calde immagini from Rossini's Semiramide, Joan Sutherland and Marilyn Horn. Australian Opera, as it was then known, had just become a full-time repertory company, and the construction of the Sydney Opera House was a big news story at the time. Initially cautious, audiences unfamiliar with opera were soon won over by the sumptuous Bonning Sutherland tour, and for the next visit in 1973, they received a hero's welcome. 3 years later, Bonning was appointed musical director of Australian Opera. Under his tenure, the opera presented an ambitious range of productions, with popular choices such as La Bohème and La Traviata rubbing shoulders with lesser-known bel canto, romantic and modern works. Bonning's approach was to work with the voices he had to hand. When one of them happened to be the world's preeminent bel canto star, it was logical to include that repertoire. As time passed, though, the arrangement became more fractious. Officials were uneasy at such a large perceived investment in the arts, and administrative disagreements in the company were picked up on by the media. Reports were made of the Bonning Sutherland Circus, and allegations of exorbitant costs and favouritism were freely bandied about by the press. Although Bonning was fully exonerated of these false rumours, his directorship of Australian Opera came to an end in 1983, following a general review of the company by the Australian Council. Still, for Bonning and Sutherland, there was no place like home, and they continued to perform and tour in Australia, sharing with their countrymen the voice that had conquered the world. Moffat Oxenbould on the Sutherland Sound.
It had incredible beauty. It was a voice of some size, and it was unusual perhaps for us who'd been used to light sopranos singing the coloratura music of the 19th century to have a voice of substance moving so freely. I think it was her humanity. I think that Joan's voice had an ability to touch your nerves and to touch your heart and to make an emotional connection with her. And it didn't disappoint. It was amazingly sure.
As a person, Joan Sutherland was frank, down-to-earth and good-humoured. Her lack of pretension cut across the rarefied world of opera and often made for hilarious anecdotes. Like the time she was in rehearsal for a La Scala production of Semiramide under Gabriele Santini. During rehearsal, Sutherland had briefly turned upstage, and the exasperated conductor roared out in Italian from the pit, "What kind of production is this? All I can see is the English behind." Joan whirled around and snapped back, "Australiano, maestro, Australiano." Joan had grown used to her statuesque size and figured that if her leading men weren't as tall as her, that was their problem. Pity the hopeful colleague who once tried to make a pass at her. Joan patted him on the head and gently said, "Don't be silly." She was drawn to the lighter side of opera. Alongside her tragic heroines, Joan also shone as the tomboy Marie in Donizetti's La Fille du Régiment, was a beguiling Rosalinda in Die Fledermaus, and a fun-loving Hannah in Lear's Merry Widow. Not all Sutherland's roles met with universal acclaim. Her performance as Violetta in La Traviata was admired for its poise, but many felt it lacked the desperate immediacy of Callas. And the spectre of the Greek diva haunted Sutherland's portrayal of Norma. Controversially, Sutherland believed Bellini's heroine was a victim of circumstance rather than a heroic figure, and her interpretation focused on the endless beauty of the vocal line rather than the role's dramatic fire. Zeffirelli likened her to a singing armchair next to the naked anguish Callas brought to the part. But Sutherland held firm, though she privately admitted it was a cow of a role. "She just never stops," Joan mourned. Neither did she. Decades after Callas retired from the opera stage, Sutherland was still singing Norma and performed the role more times than any other soprano of the century.
She was always very enigmatic in terms of people used to complain that, you know, she couldn't act like Callas, which I always thought was very unfair because I think that her own truth on stage always convinced the public. So I think she was unique. The beauty of her voice and its healthiness as she grew older was very impressive. She maybe didn't take the risks that Callas did, and there will always be people who value the risks that singers take dramatically and therefore vocally. But she had a concept of beauty and dedication to the voice, which young singers talk even now about how much they learnt from her and from watching her work.
Annalise Miskimmen. As the years passed, critics marvelled at the continued brilliance of Sutherland's voice. Despite the difficulty of her roles and a ferocious touring schedule, the famed high register was as lustrous as ever, her breath control only a shade less remarkable, and the beauty of tone, if anything, enriched by a slightly darker quality. Joan made no secret of the reason for her vocal longevity, an ironclad technique learned through those years at the piano with Richard, and constant vigilance in her choice of roles, prioritising the development of voice over a quick route to fame. Younger singers admired and adored her, in particular two who became Sutherland's most famous performing partners and global stars in their own right. Marilyn Horne, Joan's great counterpart in Norma and Semiramide, and the tenor Luciano Pavarotti. Anthony Legg.
For any singers, if you're on the stage with another singer who is fantastic, it makes you sing better. And I think Marilyn Horne and all these kind of people who were with Pavarotti were so inspired by her singing. And so suddenly they started learning from her technique. They started picking up on it. Not that they had to talk to her, but they could hear it, what she was doing. And it made them sing much better. And I think they felt that they could go on even when she wasn't singing with them and sing at a higher level. So she was basically like a singing teacher on the stage, and saying, this is how you sing. And they say, oh my God, this is obviously the right way. This is it.
While most singers would rush to learn their first Puccini role, Sutherland only came to this point at a later stage in her career. The occasion holds a treasured memory for the former director of Opera Australia, Moffat Oxenbould.
I had the good fortune to direct Dame Joan in two operas, Semiramide and Suor Angelica of Puccini. And she'd never actually sung a Puccini role on the professional stage. She'd done Tabarro as a student, and she'd recorded Turandot. But Suor Angelica, we thought, would be a good opportunity for her to... Well, it's a fiendishly difficult role. Emotionally, it's a fiendishly difficult role. And vocally, while it's only a one-act opera, it's a very power-packed one-act, single act. But, of course, it was very different from what the public had expected of Joan, because usually she had very grand costumes and big bel canto pieces, and this was a simple nun who joined in singing all the choruses, the little choruses, and was just heartbreakingly moving. It's a very difficult piece for any mother to sing, about a child being taken away from her child and then the child dying, and she hadn't even been told about it. So she was nervous about it, certainly very nervous. And all of that great humanity, her great big heart, and her humility and respect for the composer all came to the fore. And the four audiences or five audiences, however many there were, that actually heard those performances were amongst the most blessed in all the world, because it was truly a fantastic achievement. So I think Suor Angelica, which she subsequently recorded so we can all hear it, was very special.
"I'm a mum," said Sutherland in an interview. "I never thought of becoming a diva. I just wanted to sing the roles and get on with my work. I come to the theatre in a taxi, not in some Rolls Royce. I don't have time to do all that silly stuff." As she passed her 60th birthday, still singing Lucia's and Elvira's to more acclaim than any younger soprano, Joan Sutherland felt it was time to retire. It was, the critics acknowledged, a career of incredible consistency. No hysterics, no vocal breakdowns, and an absolute prioritising of her colleagues and her public. Still, the voice rang out fluently, with little trace of the passage of time. But Joan felt it was time to stop. Anthony Legg.
She didn't retire because her voice had given up. She retired because of the whole strain of living that life. You know, every day when you have to support your voice and, you know, also deal with all the publicity, the whole attention that you get, it's very tiring. And she wanted to live, you know, have a normal life. So she chose to retire because of that, not because her voice wasn't working, because it always had an amazing youthful quality. I can't describe why it was. I mean, you would never, if you'd listened to it without looking at her, you wouldn't know what age she was.
Although her last public appearance would take place in a Covent Garden production of Die Fledermaus, Sutherland's official farewell was bestowed on Opera Australia with a production of Meyerbeer's Les Huguenots on October 1990. An ensemble opera, it provided Sutherland with a small but spectacular coloratura role as Marguerite de Valois. On that last gala night, she was off stage during the last act to collect herself and to face the reception of the audience, simulcast on ABC television and beamed out to the world. Moffat Oxenbould was there.
She was quite nervous about coming back to it because she hadn't sung in public for a couple of months before she came. She always used to say, "School's never out, Moffat, school's never out," because she was always restudying something or learning something. And I remember on the first night of Huguenot, we went up in the lift together to the stage level, and I said, "Well, school's nearly out," and she said, "But it's not out yet." It was leading to this gala, which we knew was going to be televised, and by then it was known that it was her farewell to the stage. We were very honoured that she'd paid us that compliment. And it was a night filled with unbelievable love. But it was just an outpouring of love from the stage to the auditorium and the auditorium and the public back to the stage, and particularly to Joan. So many of her colleagues in the company, some of them were people that she'd been a student with. Others were colleagues from Covent Garden, from her time in Australia, so that it was a whole history, but it was such an honourable, honest career, so one couldn't be sad about it.
She was always at the heart of the opera community, I think, and held in great, great esteem. And I would hope that she realised how much joy she brought to so many people and still does. In fact, just before I came here, I was looking at something she was singing on YouTube and something came up and some fan had taken three of her high E's from various bel canto rep, looped them together, put it with a visual of the earth exploding under some kind of alien attack. And it's described as Joan Sutherland's voice destroys the world, but with the greatest kind of affection. So I hope that would appeal to her rather down-to-earth humour.
Joan Sutherland, La Stupenda, was written and presented by Liz Nolan and produced by Owen O'Kelly. The programme was first broadcast in 2011 on the first anniversary of the soprano's death.